The headlines. A new survey finds that the Eurozone economic recovery is losing steam amid rising prices caused by supply chain crisis. Russia says NATO's adoption of a new strategy against Moscow shows the confrontational nature of the Western military alliance. The mass Friday prayers resume in Iran's capital, Tehran, after a 20-month hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour, a new survey has shown that the Eurozone economic recovery is losing steam amid rising prices caused by a supply chain crisis. The survey was conducted by the London-based confirmation provider IHS Markit. It says the purchasing managers index slipped to 54.3 this month. The figure was above 56 and at 59 points in September and August, respectively. The study shows the Eurozone could falter in the near term as the pandemic continues to disrupt economies and push prices higher. Things don't seem good in the UK either. Based on official data, retail sales volumes dropped for a fifth month in a row during September. The slump is blamed on a fuel crisis that has led to delays in shipping goods and high prices. Well, to better understand the situation, we're now joined by our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's with us from Brussels, and we also have Professor of International Economics and finance, the City University, Mr. Keith Pilby, who is with us from the British capital. Let's start off with Jerome in Brussels. Jerome, how alarming are these numbers?
Well, we have known for some time that the data is not good. I mean, we have had big demand. So you have to talk about supply chain issues. There has been big demand as countries come out of lockdowns, which is, I suppose, a positive thing in terms of consumer demand. But really, the underlying problem here is not about consumer demand, but a fear over the actual pandemic itself that we could see further lockdowns and certainly restrictions being implemented. There's vaccine hesitancy in some EU countries. EU leaders have just been discussing it at a summit, which concluded just a couple of hours ago here in Brussels. So you look at Romania and Bulgaria, people are not taking the vaccine. So we're seeing a situation there whereby economies are going to be hit hard once further restrictions come in, as the hospitals become overwhelmed and so on. And even here, for example, in Belgium, where you have a high uptake of the people taking the vaccine, we are seeing increasing numbers of people being hospitalized and deaths. And so there is concern that more restrictions will come into play. So the economy is, you know, it's facing also an energy crisis. The EU leaders have been discussing that. The European Trade Union Confederation, which is an umbrella body for workers' unions, says that the big problem here in terms of the Eurozone economy is low wages. That's why we're seeing so many people in this energy crisis not being able to pay bills. And the ET, the Trade Union Confederation, the ETUC, says that even before we had this energy crisis, you had 9.5 million people in the EU, in the Eurozone, who could not actually pay their heating bills. So, you know, there is a growing social crisis. Social inequality is growing. Poverty is on the rise. And we're not seeing the true figures yet because government supports have been withdrawn. So there's the actual employment figures, people in employment, they're artificially high at the moment because government supports have been keeping people in jobs to work from home and that type of thing. Those are being removed. So actually the situation could get a lot worse before we see any improvements. Young people disproportionately impacted as usual when we have a financial crisis. They are the people who are in the most precarious jobs, part-time work, that type of thing. So we're going to see a rise as well in youth unemployment. But the big problem here, inflation is too high, of course, but the big problem here is that this uncertainty surrounding the pandemic, how is it going to go? It's affecting consumer sentiment. People don't want to spend because they're afraid of how it might impact them in terms of their jobs, that type of thing. And also in terms of investors, businesses don't want to expand. They don't, and which obviously means that jobs aren't being created because there's this uncertainty surrounding the pandemic.
Professor Pilbeam, our correspondent Jerome Hughes, first of all, said the data isn't good. He also mentioned that the uncertainty regarding the pandemic is still there. What's next in your opinion?
Yes, I sort of echo the sentiments there because you know, uncertainty hits investment. And of course, a lot of companies have actually taken on a lot of debt to survive the COVID period. And that means they've got to pay interest on that debt and ultimately pay back the debt. And that means they haven't got too much money to invest. All right. So this is also another very big problem, because we need investment to create jobs. Consumers are worried. Why? Because, yes, some of that furlough payments are ending or have ended, which have been supporting some people. And of course, governments are now beginning to cut back expenditure and raise taxes, because you have to raise taxes to pay the borrowed money from the government. And that's bound to act as a drag on consumer demand and also investment again, because corporation tax may well go up in a lot of countries. So we've got this problem of a huge debt overhang that, you know, and a lot of poor people, of course, as Wrighton said, it's the poor people that have had to borrow money. The rich people have dipped into their savings, and maybe some rich people have actually saved money. They're not travelling to work and things like this, and working from home. So we've got this asymmetry in the economy, particularly if poor people actually got up debt and now getting taxed more and getting their benefits cut. Look at what's happened in Britain with the £20 universal benefit being cut. So this really matters to these poor people, and then they're facing the inflation. Now, why is the inflation coming in? Because the central banks have been printing money. It's not just supply side shock. There's actually been unprecedented printing of money, and I promise you, eventually it starts to go into the real economy. And so inflation's picking up, which, when people are not getting pay rises to match that, lowers their living standards. So there's a real, you know, there was too much optimism about the opening, in my view, and we've got a long, hard road ahead, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I think it's going to play out not to be a very happy 2022, unfortunately.
Mr. Pilbeam, you're in London. Things in the UK, they don't seem too well either. Based on official data, retail sales volumes, they've dropped for a few months in a row now. That slump has been blamed on a fuel crisis. Let's not forget the panic buying, the delays in shipping goods, high prices, as you just mentioned. Where did Britain go wrong, in your opinion? Or, in other words, how did it go wrong for Britain?
Well, it's gone wrong in many ways. As I keep saying, one of them is having an incompetent government. Okay, the easily the most incompetent government we've ever had, with two big problems to solve. One of them being COVID. Okay, and okay, they've done very well with the vaccinations. You know, that's been reasonably well done. That's true. And that's been helpful. But they've also made many mistakes, as we know. I don't have time to go over them, but they've made many mistakes. They opened up too quickly. Okay, and now we've got the rising COVID. But of course, the other problem was self-inflicted, and it was Brexit. And what we're loathing is it's made our exports much more complicated. It means we've got an economy full of bureaucrats that don't really do much. Okay, they're just trying to reduce the frictions that are totally unneeded. And of course, we're learning about the labour. We needed the EU labour, both skilled and unskilled. Forget, you know, it's only skilled labour. No, Britain has relied heavily on what we call unskilled labour, which we now found out is very valuable to the British economy. It's not unskilled at all. Driving trucks is not an unskilled job. And so we're getting sort of this self-inflicted wound and a government that is totally incapable to listen to business. I mean, you know, Boris is very famous for saying, you know, I won't repeat it on air, but it begins with F and it's business. And that's exactly what he's done. So that's about the only thing he ever said that he's achieved. So the point is you know, it's a combination of things. But having an incompetent government full of Brexiteers, but, you know, not particularly bright lot, let's be honest, has caused a lot of the problems as well. So it's a combination of things. And there's no easy way out of it. It's not going to be solved in 6 months or even a year. I mean, the consequences are going to be with us for many years.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jerome Hughes joining us from Brussels. Also thanks to Professor Keith Pilbeam speaking to us from the British capital, London. Elsewhere, tensions escalating between Russia and the West. The Kremlin says NATO's adoption of a new strategy against Moscow shows that the military alliance has been created for confrontation. The Kremlin also defended an earlier Russian decision to sever ties with NATO, saying it was correct. Moscow says under these conditions there's no need for dialogue. This week, NATO defense ministers agreed a new master plan focusing on Russia. They said the plan aims to defend against what they called any potential Russian attack on multiple fronts. In addition to that, the Western Military Alliance accused 8 Russians of spying and expelled them. In a tit-for-tat move, Russia cut relations by shedding its diplomatic mission to NATO and the alliance's mission in Moscow. China has called on the United States to act cautiously over the Taiwan issue as tensions escalate between Washington and Beijing over the self-ruled island.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the 3 joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The official said China has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including sovereignty and territorial integrity. That all came after U.S. President Joe Biden said his country has a commitment to defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory. The island says it's an independent country. Tensions have escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reports revealed that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the U.S. is using Taiwan's push for independence as a tool to put pressure on China and to advance its agenda in the region.
Taiwan stands as a very useful place for the United States. Well, they can always prop up Taiwan as some kind of alternative example to whatever's going on in mainland China. It's also a very important military strategic point. Now, obviously, anytime you have a superpower like the United States, there is always a placing of weapons near enemies. This was previously done by the United States with Turkey aiming nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union. This is very much a continuation of that very policy. I mean, this is something that empires do. This gives the U.S. a justification for having its navy very close to Chinese waters, if not, depending on how close the actual two countries are. Because they can always say, well, our ships are docked at an ally's port, so we have a right to be there, etc. This is something that's been going on for some time now.
The Iranian capital, Tehran, has held the first congregational Friday prayers in nearly 2 years after it was halted due to concerns over the coronavirus pandemic. Hundreds of worshippers attended the prayers in the University of Tehran amid strict health protocols. The National Coronavirus Task Force, which had ordered the halt to the weekly ceremony in early 2020, authorized its resumption. The Friday prayers were, however, held in other Iranian cities following a downward trend in both cases and deaths. Amid the mass vaccination drive, more than 78 million doses of COVID vaccines have so far been administered nationwide. Iran logged over 11,000 new infections and 165 more deaths on Friday. The country's total infections stand at over 5.84 million, with nearly 125,000 deaths. Jubilant scenes in Melbourne as the Australian city emerges from strict lockdowns put to fight COVID-19. Many residents flocked to cafes, restaurants, and hair salons. Others cheered and clapped from their balconies. Melbourne has been the world's most locked-down city. Since March last year, it has endured nearly 9 months of restrictions during 6 separate lockdowns. The last round of curbs was imposed this summer when Melbourne saw an uptick in COVID infections driven by the Delta variant. The lockdowns remained in place despite public discontent that saw protests on some occasions. Other major Australian cities imposed similar measures as well. The curbs were eased after 70% of adults were fully vaccinated. Masks are still mandatory across the country. While Europe continues to struggle with the COVID-19 pandemic, with several countries on the continent reporting a rise in both infections and fatalities. Russia on Friday recorded a surge in both daily cases and deaths. The country's deaths were 1,064, marking the 4th straight day of record fatalities. There were also over 37,000 new cases in 24 hours. In neighboring Ukraine, coronavirus infections and deaths have also surged to all-time highs for the 2nd day in a row. Health authorities reported over 23,000 new cases and a further 614 deaths. Officials in the capital, Kiev, have announced tough restrictions to curb the spike. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany reported over 19,000 new cases, the highest since early May. The country's health ministry has warned that the situation is likely to worsen as winter approaches. And Pakistan is the scene of anti-government protests. People have turned out in large numbers across the country in protests at their deteriorating economic conditions.
No!
protesters took to the streets in Karachi, Lahore, Peshawar, and several other cities after the Friday prayers. They are angry at rising inflation and unemployment. The rallies were organized by a coalition of opposition parties and are set to continue for 2 weeks. The leader of the opposition in the National Assembly has called for the ouster of the government led by Prime Minister Imran Khan. Government critics say the country is run based on the dictates of the International Monetary Fund. Pakistan has recently witnessed an unprecedented hike in fuel and food prices, while its currency, the rupee, has also hit a record low. And the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says its prisoners held in Israeli jails have ended their hunger strike after reaching an agreement with prison authorities. The movement has provided no details about the agreement. It said the prisoners' demands have been met, hailing it as a victory for all the Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad also called the victory a turning point in the struggle against Israel. Some 400 members of the movement are currently in Israeli jails. More than half of them went on hunger strike on October 13th to protest punitive measures imposed on them. The measures followed the escape of 6 Palestinian inmates from a high-security Israeli jail last month. All were recaptured later. Some were put in solitary confinement. Israelis have begun the construction of new settler units in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron, also known as Al-Khanil. The project, which was approved by Israeli authorities 4 years ago, includes building 31 settler units and a military base. An Israeli anti-settlement group known as Peace Now has launched a legal action to stop the construction of the new settlement. It says the project is the first major expansion of Israeli settlements in the city in 2 decades. Palestinian residents in Al-Khalid say the new neighborhood would result in an increase in violence and consequently more restrictions on them. About 1,000 Israeli settlers live in Al-Khalid under heavy military protection. Among more than 200,000 Palestinians, all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's Security Council presentation didn't directly lead to the Iraq invasion, but it was a turning point in the U.S.-UN relations. We'll prepare for you an article written by Julian Borger. The piece is titled Colin Powell's U.N. Speech, A Decisive Moment in Undermining U.S. Credibility. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell will be most remembered for the act he most regretted, His 2003 presentation to the United Nations Security Council laying out U.S. evidence of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, which turned out not to exist. It did not directly lead to the Iraq invasion because George W. Bush was going to invade anyway, and the presentation did not succeed in its goal of persuading the UN Security Council to pass a second resolution backing military action against Iraq. But Colin Powell's speech marked a decisive moment in undermining U.S. credibility on the world stage. All the more because of the then Secretary of State's repeated insistence that his claims were based on hard intelligence. He said in the now infamous 5th of February 2003 briefing, "My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources." He added, "These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence." To drive home the point, Powell played a recording of an interpreted conversation between Iraq Army officers about a United Nations weapons inspection and displayed illustrations of the alleged weapons of mass destruction equipment to press home the urgency of the threat. But the description of the recorded conversation had been embellished to make it seem more incriminating, and the illustrations had sprung from the imaginations of Iraqi defectors telling the Bush administration what they wanted to hear. Just 2 years later, out of government, Colin Powell described the speech as a blot on his career. Colin Powell told ABC News, "I'm the one who presented it on behalf of the United States to the world, and it will always be a part of my record." He added, "It was painful. It is painful now." America's allies and rivals would later be alarmed at Donald Trump's intemperate posturing at the United Nations, for example, by his dire threats against North Korea in 2017. But it was rhetoric that was a prelude to Trump's assiduous courting of Kim Jong-un. The Colin Powell presentation was postured as a sober litany of facts, and it was a prelude to war. Richard Gowan, United Nations Director at the International Crisis Group, said, "Colin Powell's speech on Iraq marked a turning point in U.S. relations with the United Nations. I don't think that Washington's credibility at the UN has ever entirely recovered from the Iraq war and the false claims of weapons of mass destruction." He said, "Obviously, Obama claimed that he rebuilt U.S. credibility at the United Nations to a significant degree, and Donald Trump trashed it. Now Biden is claiming that he is in rebuilding mode again, but non-Western diplomats still raise Iraq as proof that you can't quite trust the United States at the United Nations. It's become the original sin of U.S.-UN relations, and Colin Powell recognized that after the event." Powell was exploited by the Bush White House for his supposed credibility among the world's diplomats and his reputation for caution, and he was comprehensively misled. He was told, for example, that his speech had been prepared by the National Security Council under Condoleezza Rice, but it was actually written by Vice President Dick Cheney's office, which had led the charge in browbeating CIA analysts into coming up with evidence, and when that failed, going around the CIA altogether. Colin Powell had only 4 days to prepare the speech, but walking into the Security Council chamber, he said he felt confident. The main claims about biological warfare vans and chemical weapons had been in the President's State of the Union speech, and he had the CIA sift through the text, throwing out a lot of stuff that was not double and triple sourced. He made the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, sit behind him in line of sight of the cameras when he sat before the UN Security Council. It was only a few weeks later that the CIA admitted the main pillars of his case were falling apart. Colin Powell said in his 2005 ABC News interview, "There were some people in the intelligence community who knew at the time that some of these sources were not good and shouldn't be relied upon, and they didn't speak up. That devastated me." Colin Powell, however, had made the decision to believe the CIA over the State Department's own Office of Intelligence and Research, INR, which submitted two intelligence reports before the speech questioning the solidity of the evidence. Asked about Colin Powell's decision to ignore the State Department's own Office of Intelligence and Research's findings, one of his senior analysts, Greg Fuhlman, told the CBS News show 60 Minutes, "I can only assume that he was doing it to loyally support the President of the United States and build the strongest possible case for arguing that there was no alternative to the use of military force." Sir Christopher Mayer, who was Britain's ambassador in Washington at the time, said, "For Colin Powell, the situation put reputation and duty in conflict," adding, "I think the sense of duty came from being a fighting soldier. When the Commander-in-Chief of the United States of America says, 'Go to New York and deliver a presentation,' a man like Powell doesn't say no." Christopher Mayer added, "He probably should have said no, and I think later on he thought to himself, 'I should have resigned,'" adding, "I think it crushed him. For the rest of his life he was mortified. I felt desperately sorry for him." The speech did not cause the Iraq War, which had been already planned by the time Powell entered the chamber, but apart from the impact on U.S. credibility, it did make its own particular contribution in the downward trajectory of West Asia. In one section of the speech, Colin Powell referred to a Jordanian-born terrorist, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, 21 times in an effort to prove a link between al-Qaeda and the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. According to an investigation by the PBS program Frontline, it helped raise Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's profile and helped give this previously obscure terrorist a mass following, paving the way for the organization that would eventually become Daesh terrorists.
We get people.
Broken Union.
More than 150 years after the Civil War, some in the U.S. are worried that another internal war might break out. Divide among the two main political parties and their supporters is very real.
If Biden wins, we coming, and we coming strong.
If I feel I need to go overturn a fraudulent election, then nobody on earth is going to hold me back.
The original Civil War has nothing on what's coming.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll talk about the political divide in the United States. What are the causes of the rifts between Americans today, and why some believe the nation is headed right for another civil war?
If there is one election outcome we can be sure of, it's that someone will want to secede. Whether it was over slavery, the first black president, or the worst white president, it turns out the only thing more American than apple pie is the desire to divide that pie into smaller, warring slices of pie.
According to a poll conducted in 2021, almost half of the respondents thought that America is going towards another civil war. Other polls show how a large number of Americans want to break up the Union. A new University of Virginia Center for Politics poll found that 52% of Trump voters said they've now favored red states seceding from the Union to form their own separate country, compared with 41% of Biden voters who said the same about blue states.
Large majorities of both Biden and Trump voters expressed some form of distrust for elected officials, media sources, and even votes they associate with the other side. A strong majority of Trump voters see no real difference between Democrats and socialists, and a majority of Biden voters at least somewhat agree there's no real difference between Republicans and fascists. Our first guest is Frank Buckley, a foundation professor of law at George Mason University. He's also author of a book titled American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Happy to be with you.
Now, Professor Buckley, please tell us which states are more in favor of seceding, actually, from the United States.
Well, which state depends on who's in the White House. When Trump was in the White House, the noises were coming from California. And now that Biden's in the White House, the noises are coming more from the American South. But in general, many Americans, whatever their party might be and whatever state they're in, are beginning seriously to think about secession.
All right, well, thank you for joining us on the program here, Professor Frank Buckley.
For decades, the United States has broken up countries and nations around the world. It has destroyed most of the original inhabitants of the very land it is built upon and broken up neighboring Mexico to form the Union of the United States, and now, more than ever, it seems that the chickens are coming home to roost.
Well, we're very divided as a people. The last year, 2020, was a difficult year in so many ways for everyone with COVID. And for Americans in particular, because of the Black Lives Matter protests, the riots, the looting, the attack on the Capitol on January the 6th, our nerves are on edge in a way that we've not seen in America, I think, since the Civil War, since 1861.
According to a poll released in July by Brightline Watch, two-thirds of Southern Republicans say they support breaking away from the U.S. and forming their own country with nearby states, while nearly half of Democrats on the West Coast would do the same. A 66% majority of Republicans in 13 Southern states, including Texas and Florida, are in favor of seceding from the Union. Half of all independents in the South agree. This is while 20% of Southern Democrats were also on board.
It also gave you a general who was incredible. He drank a little bit too much. You know who I'm talking about, right? So Robert E. Lee was a great general. And Abraham Lincoln developed a phobia. He couldn't beat Robert E. Lee. He was going crazy. I don't know if you know this story, but Robert E. Lee was winning battle after battle after battle, and Abraham Lincoln came home. He said, I can't beat Robert E. Lee. And he had all of these generals. They looked great. They were the top of their class at West Point. They were the greatest people. There's only one problem. They didn't know how the hell to win.
Support for forming a breakaway country reached 47% among Democrats in California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii. A third of West Coast independents, or 33%, were in favor of secession, along with 27% of West Coast Republicans. Our second guest is David K. Johnson, an investigative journalist and author, believes the rhetoric about secession is not serious. Welcome, David.
Glad to be here.
Is it possible to secede under the U.S. Constitution?
nobody's really in favor of secession in the United States. There is a poll done by a reputable firm, and the pollers themselves say, you know, people haven't thought about this. It is more an expression of people's unhappiness with the state of political turmoil in America. When Donald Trump was in office, we had a man who was deeply mentally ill, a lifelong criminal, and who was trying very much not only to become America's dictator, but to embolden white supremacist organizations, because Donald Trump has his whole life espoused white supremacy. Since the election of Joe Biden, Donald Trump has tried to persuade people that the election was stolen. There's exactly zero evidence of this, and in fact, after the Republicans had an audit in Arizona, it showed that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by even more votes than before this partisan pro-Trump group did its audit. But clearly in America, there are millions of people who are very unhappy about their circumstances, and in good part, this grows out of their economics. And here's a key fact. In the year 2018, the most recent solid data we have, 90% of American households had a smaller income than in 1973. Now, I'm obviously adjusting for inflation, but if in all those years from 1973 to 2018, your income didn't rise, it fell, of course people are angry and unhappy, and it's a major problem that needs to be addressed.
David K. Johnson there, appreciate you, and thank you for joining us here on We the People.
There is difference of opinion on the legality of secession of states, but most believe that states cannot legally secede from the Union.
After the defeat of the Confederacy, the Supreme Court ruled that secession from the U.S. is unconstitutional, which is why now seceding is incredibly difficult to do. If a state wanted to secede, it would likely have to amend the Constitution, and that would take either approval from two-thirds of each branch of Congress or approval at a special constitutional convention, and then further approval from three-fourths of the states. Basically, seceding is incredibly hard.
Cynthia Nicoletti, a legal history professor at the University of Virginia School of Law, believes that the Confederate president Jefferson Davis's trial was delayed for 4 years and ultimately dropped because there was concern that the prosecution could backfire and the case would raise troubling questions about the constitutionality of secession. If he were then acquitted, it would mean that the Union's war was unjustified.
So my topic today is about the legality of secession in the United States, which is the legal theory that precipitated the American Civil War. Secessionists argued that the Constitution contained a legal right for the states to depart from the federal union at will. And 11 states did that in the winter of 1860 to 61 because of President Lincoln's election. So President Abraham Lincoln was elected on a platform that pledged to end slavery in the federal territories. And white Southerners saw this as a threat to the institution of slavery. They were worried that this would put slavery on the path to ultimate extinction. And so these 11 Southern states left the Union in advance of Lincoln's inauguration.
No state per se has the right to secede, but were there a secession referendum, which is something the Democrats proposed a year ago when they thought Trump might win again, were there a referendum and it were, you know, it was ratified by the state legislature, it wouldn't be a nullity, right? So you don't have a right of secession, but I think it would be impossible to ignore what had happened. And I think that would begin a process of discussions, negotiations, a convention of the states, dividing up would be extremely messy, but not impossible.
The Capitol Hill riots was sort of a wake-up call, which showed that people of the United States and the world, for that matter, the differences and fractures among Americans is very real and very serious.
There is going to be more violence. 6 years ago, when Donald Trump announced he was running for president, I said we will not get out of this without violence. but not the kind of organized, dedicated violence that overthrows governments. This is the kind of clown show violence by a bunch of weekend self-described warriors that we saw in the insurrection at the American Capitol on January 6th, where Donald Trump told the crowd to go to the Capitol.
In recent polls, more than 60% of both Trump and Biden voters contended that they viewed the United States government as one which was primarily rigged in favor of the wealthy rather than a truly equal representative democracy. Couple that with the feelings of minorities like African Americans and Hispanics, and you could see a great divide between the people, and especially between the people and their government.
According to Pew Research, 45% of Republicans now say that Democratic policies threaten the nation's well-being, while 41% of Democrats view GOP policies in equally stark terms. The most dramatic example of this mutual hostility is this. Back in 1960, only 5% of Republicans and 4% of Democrats said they'd be displeased if a child married someone from the other major party. Half a century later, half of Republicans and more than a third of Democrats said yes, they would be somewhat or very unhappy. What makes this tribalism particularly dangerous is that it has grown at a time when one of America's core convictions, the worth of a free society, has eroded, especially among the young. They're simply less and less convinced that living in a democracy is all that important.
According to the Brookings Institute, liberals see conservatives limiting voting rights, endangering democracy, and ignoring procedural safeguards, while conservatives think progressives are turning to socialism and disrespecting freedom and liberty. Viewing others with great suspicion and doubting their motives is an indication that faith in the system is eroding and there is little goodwill in how people deal with one another. This shows that even if a civil war does not happen, there could be an increase in domestic terrorism and armed violence that would destabilize the country.
America was born of a compromise between states that allowed slavery and those that did not. And as a result, we live in America in a country that still is overshadowed by the Civil War that was fought in the 1860s. It is unbelievable that in your country, anyone would name a military base for anyone in the Pahlavi family. But in America, we have major military bases named for Confederate officers, that is, traitors who took up arms against the United States in 1861.
The American Civil War was fought from 1861 to 1865, with Americans supporting the Union or the North, with states in the South which voted to secede from the Union and created the Confederate States of America. The central reason for the Civil War was the issue of slavery.
The Southern Poverty Law Center found some 1,500 Confederate memorials across the country. More than 700 of them are statues and monuments, and 10 U.S. military bases are named for Confederate officers.
One of the main differences that today's United States has with the 19th century and the time of the Civil War is that the population of Democrats and Republicans are spread out and they are not entirely present in one state and absent in the other. The divide is there, but the people who support the divide are more spread out than they were at the time of the Civil War.
Well, I wrote a book on the subject called American Secession, and in it I referred to developments in Canada, since I originally am Canadian. And while there is no right of secession in the case of a Canadian province, nevertheless, secession is a real possibility, or was in the past in the case of Quebec. So distinguish between saying a state or province has a right of secession and whether or not secession is possible. You might not have the right, but it might happen in any event.
As it has been discussed about again and again, the issue of guns and firearms can play a big role in intensifying conflict within the country. America has an extraordinary number of guns and private militias.
According to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, a gun trade association, there are 434 million firearms in civilian possession in the United States. That is 1.3 guns per person. Semi-automatic weapons comprise around 19.8 million in total, making for a highly armed population with potentially dangerous capabilities. The issue of race, racism, economy, immigrants, etc. can all pose a threat and add to the volatile situation.
An enormous number of Americans, many tens of millions of them, find themselves in very tough straits. Where I live in Rochester, New York, which in 1967 was the richest city in America, today, one in every six people lives below half the poverty line. The U.S. government has a poverty level. It's $25,000 for a family of four. And every sixth family in my city lives on less than half of that, roughly $1,000 American dollars a month, which is a totally inadequate income. Our Congress has not paid attention to the horrible problems this is creating at the bottom of the income ladder. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are focused on the concerns and the needs of the wealthiest Americans, the banks, the major corporations, because we have a campaign finance system, and it is these wealthy interests that donate and make it possible to be elected to Congress, to the United States Senate, or to the White House. So a lot of people are very angry, but who don't understand why their economic circumstances are worse now than 50 years ago.
The United States is not a unified country when it comes to its citizens, and as it could be seen now, it's not even unified among its politicians, even though the country tries to portray itself as a free democratic state with liberal laws and freedoms. It ultimately controls most dissent by force. The police, FBI, and armed forces in the U.S. have high budgets and equipment that they use to control the citizens of the country. The problem that the United States could face now is that a considerable faction of the police and armed forces are pro-Trump and could pose a threat to the country and be one of the determining factors if a civil war breaks out.
There's a run on guns in Michigan.
Really nice, man.
And many are first-time buyers. They've gone back to the classroom to learn and into the shooting ranges because of fears of civil unrest.
Amen! Fire!
And they come in and they don't even know the process. They don't even know what they have to do. All they know is they want to buy a gun. And I'm fielding over 100 phone calls a day for that too.
I know.
Some believe the bigger, the better. Others want guns they can hide in their handbags. They're from all political sides and all driven by fear.
People are doing things that we've never even thought about doing before. Taking it to limits that we've never thought about going before.
It's almost like a deterrent more than anything else. My goal is to never, ever have to use it.
Anything can happen, so you just want to be as best prepared. You know, we're going grocery shopping after this. Stock up the cupboards. Stock up the other cupboards.
Stockpiling food.
Well, not stockpiling, but just being comfortable just in case.
One of the other issues adding to the divide in the United States is the poisonous political environment, which makes it extremely difficult to negotiate important issues and makes people angry with the federal government. People would consider drastic actions to reach their objectives in such an environment. For instance, winning the election could become a do-or-die situation.
The Biden administration is making such a mess of the economy, right? We're looking at a painful increase in inflation, which I think is attributable to the administration and its spending plans. And I can see some states thinking, boy, what a mess. We'd be better off governing ourselves more sensibly with a smaller government. you know, there are plenty of countries that have split up and have done rather well. I mean, Czechoslovakia broke into the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and, you know, they got along rather well thereafter. So it's not clear that economically this would be very painful. Of course, when one talks about secession, what one wants to do is preserve economic links. That was the case in Canadian secession, for example. The people who wanted Quebec to secede wanted to maintain certainly free trade and maybe free movement of people with the rest of Canada. So if there were to be a secession here, you can be assured that people would want to do it on terms which economically make sense. That is, preserving the great free trade zone, which is the United States of America.
And as always, the differences of opinions on inequality, racism, living standards, poverty, immigration, abortion, and many other issues also adds to the divide in the society and makes ordinary citizens angry. Politicians also tend to capitalize on these controversial issues, often blaming their political opponents for creating these problems and fanning the flames of division and tensions in the country.
America has become the most unequal major economy in the world. And I've been writing about how that came about for more than 25 years. It's the result of government policies that very few people understand. Essentially, in America, we have created a system in which we fully tax about 95% of the American people, and we allow a small segment of people, most of them fabulously wealthy, to escape taxation by, among other things, borrowing against their wealth instead of reporting income. We also have massive subsidy systems for the super rich, and I've written best-selling books documenting this from the public record. So an enormous number of Americans, many tens of millions of them, find themselves in very tough straits.
The supposed bonds, which were said to unite Americans, didn't really exist before and certainly do not exist now. The more the economic situation of ordinary people is deteriorated, the more the threat of violence and the possibility of a civil war will loom over the country. Biden's also not been able to unify the country, and the divide between the two main parties of the U.S. exists, and even politicians who do not want to secede from the Union might turn radical to satisfy the views of their voters. Well, that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. You join us next week on another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.